And I'm like, the cops? What the heck is this all about?
Welcome to the mysterious and unbelievable case of the Bat Boy and the Hot Dogs, Episode 2. I'm Josh Durham.
And I'm Ashley Pace.
So, Ashley, tell me what it's been like to see this project of ours go live and put out into the world.
It's been really awesome. You know, it's really hard to believe. You know, we have listeners all over the U.S. and around the world. It's surreal.
It's also been pretty cool to hear from some of the players that we've talked about that they've listened to our podcast and that they've really enjoyed it. You ready to get going?
Sounds good. Let's roll.
In episode one, we introduced you to Burlington, North Carolina and Burlington Athletic Stadium. We also told you a little bit about Frank Monastero. He was the kid from Norristown, Pennsylvania, for whom 1990 was his only season of professional baseball. Remember, Ashley Pace, the Bat Boy, got caught running hot dogs for Frank before a game. That violated the team rules set by manager Dave Keller. Players called him Oso, which is Spanish for bear. They also called him King Kong.
We also started that first episode by asking about the people we crossed paths with decades ago and whether they remember us. And we're finding out that the answer is, sometimes they do. Relief pitcher Tony Tillman from the 1990 team, for example. He definitely remembers me, the Bat Boy.
I remember you. Do you? Yeah, I remember you getting those bats, man, and standing over there, sitting in the chair. And
we need to tell you about that chair, because the incident with the hot dogs in the dugout corridor, that wasn't the only time that Ashley got into trouble that season.
Yeah, unfortunately, it wasn't.
So tell us about that chair.
So some of the games I would sit outside the dugout, right outside the top of the stairs to the right side, I guess, as you were looking out the dugout.
So this was literally on the playing field.
On the playing surface, yes. And there happened to be a game where the Indians were in the field and there was a pop-up that was coming back and it was heading right toward me. Logically, I got up and moved out of the way, except I didn't take the chair with me. And John Martinez, who was one of the catchers, wound up putting his leg through the chair. And he was not happy with me when that happened.
And I'm guessing he did not make the catch on the pop foul.
I thought he did. My recollection is that he did.
I remember he did not. And he was some kind of ticked off that this idiot Bat Boy had left the chair there.
Yeah. I was just looking out for me. I needed to get out of the way. I didn't want to get hit by the ball.
Tell me, were you surprised to hear that Tony Tillman remembered you after 30 years?
Absolutely. Some of the people, obviously, they'll remember who were on the team, but staff and stuff, I didn't expect any of them to remember me.
And Tony Tillman wasn't the only one to remember Ashley from that team. Here's manager Dave Keller. Remember, he was the one who busted Ashley when Ashley was running hot dogs for Frank Monastero.
I know Ashley all the time was going to the concession stand getting nachos and hot dogs all the time and get them to the players. So he thinks he was getting over on me, but he really wasn't.
But we'll get to that. Let's talk about how that summer started for the Burlington Indians.
The 1990 team started showing up in Burlington in the middle of June 1990. There were so many future major leaguers on that team. Guys like Dave Malicki. 7 years later, in the first ever interleague game between the Mets and the Yankees, Malicki was with the Mets and he threw a complete game shutout in Yankee Stadium.
There was also Steve Gajkowski. He'd get called up to the Mariners in 1998. Of course, it was hard to tell back then who the stars were going to be.
Here's Dave Keller on that very point.
You know, obviously, When you have players that young, I don't think anybody can sit and go, this guy's a Hall of Famer, or this guy's going to pitch in the big leagues for 15 years, or this guy's going to dominate, he's going to be an all-star, he's going to be just a huge force at the big league level. I don't think anybody can really come out and honestly say that. A lot of people will say, you know, I really loved that kid when he was young, and I thought he was going to be a great player, and all that. But after doing this for as long as I have, you know, all you can really come up with, I think, sometimes is that this guy's got a chance to be special. And then it makes you realize how special everybody is that plays in the big leagues.
Alan Embry was another future major leaguer who came to Burlington in 1990. We heard a little bit from him in episode one. He flew into Greensboro from the state of Washington, and my older brother Tripp Durham was there to pick him up. Tripp had been with the Indians since they started in Burlington in 1986, and in 1988, he got to be witness to baseball history.
2 years prior, in 1988, when I was the clubhouse manager, my third and final year being the clubby for the then Burlington Indians, we played a 27-inning game against the Bluefield Orioles. Now, it is still the longest game, time-wise, continuous play in professional baseball history. Rochester played in a game that was 33 innings, but that game was suspended and then restarted the following day. This game with the Burlington Indians in 1988 started just after 7:15 and did not end until just after 3:30 the following morning, so 27 innings. Several things that really stood out to me for that game is that Carlos Mota, the nephew of Manny Mota, he was the catcher for the Burlington Indians. He caught all 27 innings of that game. We had a reserve catcher by the name of Brian Johnson. Brian had fallen asleep on the bench somewhere after the 21st inning, and he was called upon by Mike Bucci, the manager, to pinch hit in the bottom half of an inning, and Brian was asleep on the bench. He woke up after he got the call to pinch hit, walked to the batter's circle, grabbed a bat, went to the batter's box, swung at the first pitch, sharp line drive to left field, walked back to the batter's circle, dropped the bat, went back to the bench, fell back asleep. All of that in just about the time that I just described it. We get to the top of the 27th inning, and the only arm left to throw for the Burlington Indians is Dan Williams. Dan, a reserve catcher, brother of famed San Francisco Giant third baseman Matt Williams. Dan gets tagged with the loss because he gives up a bloop single that allows Bluefield to push a couple of runners over. 3-2 at the top of the 27th is the score. And in the bottom of the 27th, Burlington just cannot get it done. So at 3:37 a.m. on the morning of June the 25th, the box score becomes final. Bluefield wins 3-2.
Another funny part of that story had to do with merchandise. They printed up 500 I Survived the 27-inning game t-shirts.
Now remember, there were 84 people left in the ballpark when it was all said and done. Burlington sold out of all 500 t-shirts and reordered and sold a couple of hundred more after that.
Malicki, Gajkowski, and Embry, they weren't the only ones who would make it all the way to the major leagues.
Darryl Whitmore was another major leaguer that came to Burlington in 1990.
He was the one who said you could hula hoop with a Cheerio, right?
Yep. It was really cool to have him there because he was a standout free safety for the West Virginia Mountaineers.
Whitmore was actually one of two-sport athletes who came to Burlington at the start of that summer. Jeff Brom was the other. Brom was the starting quarterback for the Louisville Cardinals.
Yeah, I think Darryl was a great athlete himself. We both were fortunate to get a chance to play both sports. It kind of wasn't real common then, other than, you know, I know Bo Jackson was doing it, and it was like, well, hey, you know, let's see if maybe we can pull off both of these.
Brom eventually pursued football, though, so there was no major league career for him.
And there were so many other guys on the team that I remember. Guys who didn't make it, like pitcher Dickie Brown.
I remember him as being really skinny guy and always in motion, like he had some kind of real nervous energy about him.
You can see all the guys we're talking about by visiting our Facebook page. Just search for Bat Boy and the Hot Dogs. Some of the guys I remember were the Latin players from the Dominican, especially Pedro Henderson, Ramon Torres, Johnny Martinez, and of course, Roberto Jimenez.
Roberto Jimenez, one of the catchers. Man, we loved Roberto. he hardly spoke a word of English. It was his second year in Burlington, and Dave Keller's got a really great story about Roberto.
Catcher from the Dominican Republic, and I remember a game that we played in Plant City during extended spring when, and this is really hard to explain over the phone, and you need a visual to be able to understand it, but he was catching in a game at Plant City, and he squatted down, the ball's right down the middle, and the umpire calls it a ball, and he tries to hold his glove there and actually stands up and turns sideways with his glove there and looks back at the umpire and says, "That's a ball." And at the time, I mean, it's a coaching moment for the coaches because you got to be able to explain to the player. You can't do that and get the umpire pissed off at you. But at the same time, it was absolutely hilarious how funny it was, just the body language and how he went about trying to explain to the umpire that that ball's right down the middle. There's no way you can call that a ball.
Tracy Sanders, he was another great guy on that team, too. Remember Tracy?
Absolutely. He was a North Carolina guy. Always, he always had a smile on his face. You know, I mentioned, you know, in the last episode about Frank, Tracy was another one of those guys who, you know, always seemed happy, always happy to be there. Just a real good guy. He was drafted in the 58th round.
Yeah, I think that was just one round ahead of Frank Monastero.
Yeah, you know, the late round guys, they don't get huge signing bonuses. Tony Tillman told me what Tracy actually signed for.
He signed for a 6-inch roast beef and a Coke at Subway. That was his joke. I love that guy. He was awesome.
But I tell you, someone who we got to know on the opposite end of a 6-cent roast beef signing bonus was Sam Hintz.
Yep. Sam was from Mississippi. He was a sandwich pick between the first round and the second round. I distinctly remember him talking about his signing bonus, and I'm pretty sure he told me that he had bought 5 cars.
Manager Dave Keller certainly remembers Sam Hintz as well.
Sammy's one of my favorite guys off that team. He had never been out of Wiggins, Mississippi in his whole life. And Dan O'Dowd called me and said, "Listen, we got this guy that we signed in the second round. His name's Sam Hintz. He's from Wiggins, Mississippi. He's never been on a plane. He's never been out of Wiggins. So I need you to go to the airport and in Greensboro and wait for him to get off the plane and make sure you're waiting for him at baggage claim and personally take him back to Burlington."
And here's where Oso, King Kong, got all soft on us. I'm not sure we expected that.
Sammy and I were like very, very close. And he was very quiet. And I loved him just like a son, just like almost all those kids, man. You find a way to fall in love with them like they're your son because you put so much time and effort into everything they do. And you're trying to help them accomplish their goals.
And, of course, there was Frank Monastero.
Frankie was a beauty and always kind of happy-go-lucky, always in a good mood. He just loved being around and playing, man.
The 1990 season got off to a great start. Alan Embry got to start the season opener, which was at home, Thursday, June 21st, 1990, against the Martinsville Phillies. We asked Embry, 30 years later, whether he even remembered that first professional start.
I remember the day. I don't remember what happened.
I told him that he threw 5 shutout innings and got the win, but he only cared about one thing.
How many walks?
He even took a guess during our conversation.
5 or 6 strikeouts and 5 or 6 walks.
He actually had 6 strikeouts and just 2 walks.
One voice you've not yet heard on this podcast is a voice that was familiar to so many Burlington Indians fans that summer. It's that of Andy Young. He was the team's play-by-play announcer on the radio. Remember in episode 1 when former college intern Dave Burke described a house where he lived upstairs with no AC and lost 20 pounds? Andy Young lived downstairs. Anyway, we caught up with Andy, and he gave us a recap of the Indians' first five games, which the Indians won.
Embry, first game, 8-0. Embry, 5 innings. Carl Johnson, 4 innings. Obviously, shutout. Second game, Alan Walden, 5 2/3. Tony Tillman, 3 1/3. Tillman got the win, 5-4.
All right, notice how Tillman came in relief of Alan Walden and got the win? Tillman says he did that several times that season, and it earned him a unique nickname.
And they had a couple of nicknames for me. One was Sarge. They called me Sarge in the bullpen. I'm not really sure why they called me that. And then when they were really wanting to tease me a little bit, they called me Snake because, the first half of that season, I led the league in wins as a reliever. And what would happen is, you know, like Alan would go out and pitch 4 2/3 innings, and they'd take him out. And then I'd come in and pitch 2 innings and get the win. So they called me Snake. You know, they were teasing me a lot about that.
But here's Andy Young again on games 3, 4, and 5.
Sean Bryant starts the third game. Five innings pitched, 1 run, 2 hits, 8 strikeouts. Fourth game is Dickie Brown. This is where was he from? Connors State Junior College in Oklahoma. It's his first professional start, and I think he was a converted infielder or outfielder. He had a no-hitter after 8 innings. He hit the first guy up in the ninth with a pitch and then gave up a single to Falconer Medina, and so they took him out. But he had his line for the night. It's his first professional start. Eight-plus innings pitched, 1 run, 1 hit, 1 walk, 7 strikeouts. So, and let's see, who's the fifth? And Steve Gutkowski was this fifth starter, and he played in the big leagues, too, very briefly.
Tillman, the Snake, got the win in that one, too. And how did outfielder Sam Hintz, the Sandwich Pick, do? It took a few games for him to get in.
As a matter of fact, I can look this up, but the first time he did play, here we go, fifth night, it was Darryl Whitmore, Sam Hintz, and Pedro Henderson. Let's see. What I remember was Sam breaking his bat 3 times. Yeah, he walked in the first inning, grounded to short, broke his bat, struck out, grounded to first. So it didn't hit the ball out of the infield. And I remember him breaking at least 2 bats. And the thing was, he had never hit with a wood bat before.
Sammy's broken bats notwithstanding, the Indians raced off to a 5-0 start and looked like world beaters. That was due in part to one player we've not yet mentioned on this podcast, a kid from Peoria, Illinois, who was drafted in the 13th round the year before.
Jim Thome. He definitely turned a lot of heads in 1990, and people are still talking about that summer.
So Jim Thome had played in the Gulf Coast League the year before. That's actually lower than the Appalachian League where the Indians played. Teams in the Gulf Coast League play at the spring training complexes of their parent clubs. It's much more about skill development than competition.
Thome only hit .237 in the Gulf Coast League in 1989, and he didn't hit a single home run. Here's former college intern Dave Burke on seeing Thome in Burlington in 1990.
Now, I still remember Jim Thome hitting a line drive, and it was right before we put the tarp on the field, but they were still playing, and it was 180, but he literally hit a line drive home run over that landed on the building behind the right field wall. But it was just a massive, massive home run, and you know that's when he started really coming along because beforehand, you know, Thome didn't put up impressive numbers, you know, before Burlington. Burlington is when he just exploded onto the scene.
Jeff Brom, the two-sport athlete, remembers Thome as well.
Well, you know what? He was a special talent because he was somebody I know when he got drafted wasn't a high-level prospect and I think struggled his first year. And you know what? All of a sudden, man, you saw him take off. He was a guy that I think his second year in the minors, maybe halfway through the year, all of a sudden you're just like, holy cow, this guy has really turned it on. And big and strong and athletic, and he just started seeing the ball and hitting it. And when he did, boy, he could mash the ball. I mean, really could mash it all over the field. He could pull it. He could go the opposite way, but a tremendous talent and somebody that, you know, I enjoyed watching and watching him develop.
But Tony Tillman probably sums Thome up best.
He was probably the best hitter I've ever seen. I've seen him walking with bases loaded he was just a hitting machine. I was always amazed and loved to watch him take batting practice. And, of course, in the game, because he had a sweet swing, man, with such power, you know.
Jim Thome wasn't the only one hitting well. Tracy Sanders was, too. Ashley, how was our guy Frank Monastero doing?
Well, he was battling for some playing time. Miguel Flores got the starts at second base. He did get in a couple of those first games. He even drew a key walk in the bottom of the ninth in their second game, and he proved to be the tying run in a pretty thrilling come-from-behind win. He also helped preserve Dickie Brown's quest for a no-hitter by making a diving catch off a line drive.
And what all were Ashley and I doing that summer? Well, Ashley definitely wasn't running food, at least not in the beginning of the season.
No, the guys would ask me to get food. I specifically remember Jeff Brom asking. There was some time where the whole team was lined up along the fence, and I remember him asking me to, you know, go get some hot dogs or nachos or whatever it was. And I was just not willing to, you know, put my life on the line at that point.
Now, when the game started, you didn't always sit in the Indians dugout, though, did you?
No, sometimes I was on the visiting team side. Mostly was in the Indians dugout, but from time to time I'd be working for the visiting team.
As the camera guy, I had to film the Indians' pitchers and batters. When the Indians were in the field, that was pretty easy. I got a prime spot right behind home plate. I had one of those old RCA camcorders, you know, the big ones that sat on your shoulder and took full VHS tapes. When I was sitting there behind home plate filming the pitchers, I had pretty good company from the other Indians pitchers who had the night off. They sat in the stands and ran the radar gun, and they got to eat. That made Alan Embry particularly happy.
These Burlington Indians, if you haven't noticed, they love to eat. But getting to the ballpark hours before the game, and with Dave Keller's rules about food, well, it was too much for Embry.
Think about it. There is nothing until after the game. I also remember going to the bullpen and buying food.
But running the radar gun, that's a whole new ball game.
And when you're a radar gun guy, when you're a starter, you get to go to do the radar gun. So you get to go eat. Was Sam Baker on our team? Yes, Sam was on our team. He's the one that started me. He was doing the radar gun one night. He comes up eating a hot dog, and he's giving me radar gun readings or something. I'm like, you get to do that? He goes, yeah, when you do the radar gun, you're in close. You do whatever you want. I go, sweet.
So when the Indians came up to bat, you had to move, didn't you?
Yeah, that's when things got challenging. If it was a right-handed batter, I'd have to go to the end of the grandstand and step out onto the top of the visitor's dugouts on the first base side. Anyway, I'd sit there and film the whole at-bat. And if a left-handed batter came up next in the batting order, I had to film him from the other side. I'd race through the grandstand, I'd dodge fans, I'd leap onto the first or second row of the metal bleachers to avoid them, I'd get to the other end, step out onto the Indians' dugout on the third base side, and film the left-handed batter. That's where I was the night Thome launched that bomb over right field onto the roof of the building. If a right-hander came up next, well, I had to race again to the other side.
So it's pretty amazing that you never knocked anyone down or killed anybody. When the games were over, Josh and I got to run various players home. Typically, we'd run the Latin guys home, the ones who didn't speak a lot of English. They were great guys. We'd go over. I don't remember exactly everybody that was in the apartment, but it was probably, you know, Roberto Jimenez, John Martinez, maybe Pedro Henderson, maybe Ramon Torres. I remember there was a lot of cooking going on, a lot of rice and chicken, and a lot of video game playing.
You mentioned the cooking. I remember all the spices. I mean, I remember walking into their apartment and they were cooking up a storm, and it did not smell like anything that I was accustomed to growing up in Burlington, North Carolina. And I think I was pretty scared to try anything. And I remember that I did not try anything.
No, I don't remember trying any of it.
But we did give some other players rides home, too. You remember giving Darrell Whitmore a ride home, right?
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember the name of the street. And it's a huge hill down, and then it comes back up. And I remember we had your, I guess, stepdad's Oldsmobile of some sort.
Yeah, it was something like that.
and so I guess you were driving, and I was riding shotgun, and Whitmore's in the back. And you would just race that thing down the hill and up the hill again. And I just remember Whitmore just screaming in laughter in the back seat saying, "Do it again, do it again, do it again."
Yeah, we were having a pretty good time.
I mean, this is a two-sport athlete, a all-American football player, great baseball player. He'd make it to the major leagues. Probably not the best thing for us to be doing.
Yeah, probably not the smartest thing for us, for sure.
Yeah, and it didn't sound like people were making the best decisions that summer. Remember in episode one when Tony Tillman described how the people of Burlington were always so kind and so glad to see them around town and wouldn't even let them pay for their meals sometimes?
Well, not everyone in the area was glad to see them. Here's Tony Tillman.
Well, I'll tell you a story that don't nobody knows. At Elon College, there's a bar on the corner of the road, and it's where all the football players hang out, and a lot of college students. And it has pool tables in there and a bar. And we all went there one night. It's carload of us, probably six, seven of us. The guy started, you know, some of the people didn't like you in town. Not everybody liked you. Well, evidently, these guys didn't like us. They didn't like us being in that bar. They didn't like us, and they started talking a lot of smack, and one thing led to another, and we got in a fight in that bar. I mean, a knockdown, drag-out fight. I mean, there was probably six or seven of us and about 20 of them, and we ended up running out of the front door, and I forgot who went and got the car. I think Pincus went and got the car.
That's Mike Pincus he's talking about, one of the team's infielders.
And he stopped in the front door and opened the door, and we all ran out and jumped in the windows. I won't never forget. I jumped in the back window, and I was like one of the last ones, and I was laying on top of everybody. We were all screaming and hollering, and I remember looking out the back glass, and it looked like a mob. I mean, there's at least 20 guys running right behind the car and throwing beer bottles. You could hear the bottle boom, boom, boom hitting the car. And that's one night I'll never forget.
Just a couple of miles down the road, you and I were also getting into some trouble.
Yeah, so Josh and I had a really good friend that lived not too far from where Tillman just described. For purposes of this podcast, we're going to call her Katie. And she had a sister whom we're going to call, I don't know, Amanda.
We'd go over to their house on late summer nights and tap on one of their bedroom windows, and they'd come out to see us. And there was a golf course that you could get to pretty near there, and we'd wander over to the course and just sort of hang out looking at the summer night sky.
But they lived on a busy road, and we had to park a street over and then walk to their yard. Well, one night, the cops came after us.
The blue lights were flashing.
And I'm like, the cops? What the heck is this all about?
Yeah, they shout after us to stop, and they approach us and really start giving us the third degree out there.
Yeah, there's apparently been a bunch of car break-ins in the area.
Keep in mind, we've just come from an Indians baseball game. Ashley, who you've heard can hula hoop with a Cheerio, is still in his white, spotless Indians bat boy uniform. I mean, what the heck kind of car break-in ring are these guys even looking for?
It was really unbelievable. Thankfully, they let us go.
Of course, to be fair, you did start breaking Dave Keller's food rules that summer, too.
Yeah, the players finally wore me down.
Going back to players who remember you, Alan Embry remembers you as well. When I asked him whether he ever got caught getting food, here's what he said.
I don't know. I think I hid my stuff pretty well. and actually probably did help me along that way.
And as we said at the beginning of this episode, Dave Keller definitely remembers you.
I know Ashley all the time was going to the concession stand getting nachos and hot dogs all the time and get them to the players. So he thinks he was getting over on me, but he really wasn't.
What's it like to hear that 30 years after the fact?
It's pretty funny, you know, because I thought I was getting over on him back then. And, you know, obviously he was on to everything that was going on.
Do you think he was really lying in wait to catch you?
He probably was. I have a feeling, you know, he was looking for his chance to bust me.
So here's what I recall about the whole thing. I remember standing near first base, raking the dirt, helping to get the field ready for the game. And I remember you coming out from the Indians dugout, sort of cutting across the field in front of the pitcher's mound.
Yep.
I think it was maybe the day after Frank got busted. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was when it was.
I don't remember hearing about it the night he got busted. But yeah, the next night before the game, you come up and I mean, I think you're in a bit of a panic. You're telling me what happened the night before, that Frank had gotten busted, or you got busted bringing Frank some hot dogs. And
Yep.
That he denied it or was trying to get out of it. And we had to come up with some sort of way to try to get him out of it. That's kind of what I remember.
Yeah, that's definitely what I remember. I remember being pretty nervous about it. You know, as we've noted, Dave Keller was a pretty big guy. You know, wasn't a mean guy, but, you know, he was an imposing figure. And, you know, getting caught up in this running food to the players, you know, had me a little nervous about it.
As I recall, we did come up with a pretty ingenious defense for our, Mr. Monastero.
We did. We talked it out and came up with the perfect solution in our minds. But I still don't know to this day whether the defense actually worked.
It had to. I mean, it was so ridiculously genius.
I really can't wait to find out.
You'll hear about all of that and more on the next episodes of the mysterious and unbelievable case of the Bat Boy and the Hot Dogs. Wait, stop the music. Remember how we said at the beginning of the episode how great it was to hear from some of the people that we've been talking about?
Yep. Folks like Andy Young and Tony Tillman, they've listened to episode one and loved it.
Who else did you hear from, Ashley?
Well, I may have heard from a certain someone from Norristown, Pennsylvania.
You'll hear about all of that and more on the next episodes of the mysterious and unbelievable case of the Bat Boy and the Hot Dogs.
Our music is once again courtesy of the band Cabinet. Find them online at cabinetmusic.com or on Facebook and Instagram at Cabinet Music.